Hey everybody, welcome back to Historians of the Movies podcast. I am your host and creator, Jason Herbert, where every single week we are bringing you discussions about history and film and history and, you know, everything else in between that we can think about. And this week, we wanted to talk about the TV show 1883. It's our very first time where we're talking about a TV series on the show, but I think in a lot of ways this makes a lot of sense as the formats and production values have grown and developed. I think that long-form television series offer us different kinds of ways to talk about the past. And with Taylor Sheridan's series certainly coming from Yellowstone, 1883, 1923, now Lawmen, the Bass Reeves show, he's talking about a lot of really interesting things in the West. And I wanted to bring that to you because I think a lot of you have voiced your interest in talking more and more about that. So I brought on for you two amazing scholars, Josh Garrett Davis and Sarah Kies, both of whom have experience and expertise in both in the history of film and Westerns in film, and also more recently Sarah's new book, which talks about the Overland Trail and the experiences of settler colonists as they crossed that trail and frankly died on that trail. So we talked a lot today about 1883. We talked about a lot of different books about the West, envisioning the West, what happened on that trail, what this series gets right, what drives us nuts about this series as well, our favorite films about the West, and where we think the field is going. So I think you're really going to enjoy this podcast today. I had a blast just talking to my two friends here, talking about 1883. Hope to have them back again soon. And I think you're really going to enjoy it. So saddle up, because 1883 is next on Historians of the Movies podcast. Sarah, Josh, what's going on? How are you guys today?
Doing great. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, I'm doing well.
See, I already know that you're doing great. It's like people should know when we're listening to these pods. Like, we've already been talking for like 15 minutes already. Like, I've literally left, got coffee, accidentally logged off, logged back in. I don't even know how you're – I never know how to start these things, but like, hi, how you guys doing? You know, it's like better than people on the trail in 1883. I can promise you that much. Like
– yeah, the start of that was just they were throwing everything at them right away.
I know, right? But I dig. It's like that show starts off like, oh, shit, which is awesome. I'm also excited because this is the very first time I think we've actually mentioned the show within the first half an hour of talking about said movie on this podcast, because it's usually like Jason sees something pretty and then I'm distracted for half an hour. So, yeah, I'm so excited to talk to you guys about this show. I feel like, you know, 1883, the Yellowstone thing entirely. We're kind of talking behind the scenes. Sarah, Josh, you know, in some of the emails we'd had a little bit before we were doing this about how seems to be this newfound interest in the West as far as pop culture and things like that. And I'm really interested. And it really does seem like maybe this longer form format where we're seeing these Yellowstones, 1883, 1923, these other shows that are on right now, Res Dogs, you know, you could argue certainly I think is a nouveau Western perhaps. That it's out there. And I think that's a really cool thing, especially considering both of your works are super relevant to this conversation today. So before we jump into 1883 and we're talking about this, maybe you guys can introduce yourselves a little bit, talk a little bit about your work and what you're doing here. And then we'll jump into 1883 and we'll talk about the West and this Overland Trail and depictions of the West today and just kind of jump into it. So Josh, you were here first. You want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Hey, I'm Josh Garrett Davis. My full title is the H. Russell Smith Foundation Curator of Western History at the Huntington Library and Museum and Botanical Gardens.
Fancy. It's fancy name.
Yeah. But I'm really new in that job. And actually for the past 8 years, I was a curator of Western history, popular culture, and firearms at the Autry Museum of the American West, which in a way is probably why I'm here. Because at the Autry, I inherited a film series that they screen films every month, at least, called What is a Western? And through the kind of process of trying to tweak and provoke where that series would go, I ended up sort of learning a lot about Westerns, because I didn't come into it as a fan of Westerns per se. I mean, we can talk about that later, but I ended up kind of getting, when you're the curator of Western history, popular culture, and firearms at the Autry Museum, you end up, you need to learn about Westerns. So yeah, so that I ended up writing a book of kind of different essays and riffs about Western stories broadly construed, and really trying to stretch the definition of Westerns. And so yeah, that's a great launching point, I think, to encounter 1883, which actually is far more kind of obviously a Western than a lot of stuff I was pushing on there.
It's not so much of a stretch.
Sarah?
Yeah, I'm Sarah Kies. I'm an assistant, soon to be associate professor of history at the University of Nevada, Reno. And I specialize in the U.S. West, particularly the 19th century. My book on the Overland Trail, so the Oregon and California trails, just came out a couple months ago. So I'm super excited about that. It's called American Burial Ground, A New History of the Overland Trail. And, you know, watching 1883 was a little bit uncanny for me, because Taylor Sheridan focuses so much on death, dying, and burial, which is the central theme of my book. Although I think his message is a little bit different than mine. Could definitely see where he was drawing from. He's comfortable with the source material here, is my take on it.
He's comfortable with a lot of really uncomfortable stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, whenever Sarah, you and I have known each other for, I don't know, about a decade or so. And mm-hmm. like whenever I, you know, your book was coming out and I thought of it, I had seen 1883 before. I was like, hey, I feel like this works for you. And you had not seen the series before.
I had not. Right? I think I actually, my first suggestion was something where, Jason, you were probably like, I don't know. And then you said do 1883. And I mean, I know you, I trust you. And, you know, I know your work on HATM, and I was like, okay, let's do it. And then I started doing events for the book, and every single event I've done, someone has mentioned 1883. And then I started watching it, and I was like, absolutely, this is straight in my wheelhouse in terms of subject matter.
Yeah, I gave you 10 hours of homework before we I was like, you know, usually
but homework you can do while you eat popcorn, so it's okay.
You know, I have to watch Minority Report tonight. That's like part okay. of my homework later on, because we're doing a thing about policing in New York later on in the 1920s. So now we're going to – whatever. But yeah, it was like – usually it's like, hi, here's a movie that's 2 hours of like, hi, Sarah, could you watch a 10-episode series about death and sadness in Texas and everywhere else? And then you're like, you know what? I've got a friend we could rope in on this as well. I was like, let's do this.
Yeah.
So
Josh and I should have split the episodes.
Yeah, yeah. You assigned 20 hours of homework, really.
Well, you know, had we done this, you know, had we done this podcast earlier, you know, maybe it would have been an opportunity to time to kind of break down each episode. But I think really this show does really kind of feel like a definitive, you know, real long film, because it does have a definitive end to it. There's no season two to 1883. I mean, I think that they're doing some really interesting things within like that Yellowstone universe by moving around from 1883 now to 1923. And I think they're going to do some set like after that, before the current Yellowstone series is set. I think they're doing some really interesting anthology kind of stuff. Almost like, I don't know, Louis L'Amour, you know, McMurtry. I don't know. It kind of feels-esque, you know, especially the Yellowstone series, which I don't like as much. But this series in 23, I do. But all right, quick question here to get you guys on the record for the longstanding HATM feud. Where do you stand? Coke versus Pepsi. Where are you guys at? How do you feel?
I'm kind of neither, but the fact I haven't even tasted a Pepsi in probably 25 years, where I have had a Coke a few times, but I don't really. So I don't even know what Pepsi tastes like anymore. So
that's good
I
enough.
Have to go with Coke. Yeah.
Good. Sarah?
I'm going with Coke because I know that's the right answer. but I'm also going with Coke because I honestly think it was a family thing. That was what we had. Like, if we did get a soda, it was Coke, and that was what we ordered. But you know, that bite to it, and then like all the marketing with like the Olympics, McDonald's, it's always been part of the scene for me in a way that Pepsi hasn't been.
Where are you guys from originally? Are you from the South, from the West? Where are you from?
I'm from South Dakota, so somewhat relevant to this. I'm from Yellowstone country, or at least people who watch Yellowstone country.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, I'm from the West. I'm from California. Well, some people would question whether that was Western, but
is California the West?
I think so.
I think so, right?
You know, when I was, I kind of got into Western history and stuff in undergrad, and it was like my first class of college, and the teacher had us, who actually like became my longtime life mentor advisor, Marnie Sandweiss, a Western historian. She had us draw a picture or a map of the American West. And I think the only student who could actually place every state correctly. It was on the East Coast, but I did not include the West Coast. From my perspective, growing up in South Dakota, the West Coast was cool and the West was not cool. And so that like, you know, I like envied urban kind of worldly places and did not consider where I was from to be part of the same world as California. Now, with the scholarly distance and thinking about history and stuff, I do consider the West Coast to be the West. But I will say that there was an instinctual exclusion of the West Coast in my head as a teenager.
All right. Well, this is like my favorite question to ask, actually, which is if we can put on our Frederick Jackson Turner hats on, people are like, who really more Turner is like, yeah, we're brought to you by FJT. What's the West? Because I was like hearing these different interpretations of like thematic ideas, right? Because we think of the West not necessarily as a direction, certainly as a theme in history. Sarah, you certainly reference it in your amazing book that I'm just going to plug for the next hour and a half. But what is the West? When you conceptualize, when you talk about the West, where, when, how, what is it?
I'm going to let Sarah answer this.
Oh, I have to go first?
Yes, you have to go first.
Well, I'm actually really excited to have this conversation with both of you, because I think your training, your background, your interests means we're going to have a really nice chance to chat about this. But I actually, when I teach the West at UNR in Reno, I have my students do a map, just like Josh did in his undergrad class. And they use the Mississippi River, if they kind of have a sense of where that is. I always get a gold miner, I always get a wagon, so I always get the, you know, Overland Trail in there. But then I'm in Nevada, so I get a lot of depictions of like mining and lumber and like other extractive resources and things like that. So for me, I do think of the West as geographically bound, although that changes over time, depending on, you know, where white colonization has gotten to. And I do think of the West as a place that's both urban and rural, and one that is very much, you know, thinking back to Patty Nelson Limerick's, you know, groundbreaking work for New Western History. It's about, you know, extraction, plunder, profit, and the boom and bust economy, all wrapped up in a pretty bow of the spirit of adventure, right? Which we get to sort of push back against in our scholarly analyses.
Nice. I was asked this in my interview at the Huntington of how I would define, and I hadn't planned it, but I just sort of was like, I don't even know if I think the West exists.
Oh, nice answer.
Like,
that's a good one. Like, what do you think, committee? Just turn it right back on them. Yeah. How would you say I'm qualified? You know?
Yeah, how would you say I'm qualified?
Tell me I'm pretty.
Tell me my accomplishments. No.
Right. Tell me why I'm sitting here.
But I just sort of, you know, because you can keep like making counter arguments or like a reason why the Philippines is part of the American West, or why Western Massachusetts is part of the American West in a certain time and place, or you know, like, and then I've been over the course of recent years, maybe living in LA, like increasingly feeling that we're so provincial in American history, and that like at least the whole hemisphere, if not a lot of places in the world, have a lot of similar practices of plunder and settler colonialism and boom and bust economies. And so in a way it's sort of like, there's no kind of one place where that is the case. Right. And then I sort of said, but I do know that in the mind of the public, as a public historian, the West very much exists, and it has a wagon and a gold miner, and it has a cowboy and a Plains Native American person, and you know, a very it's an idea. It's almost it's like a metaphor for all of that boom and bust and plunder and settlement and migration and all of those things. Maybe I don't know. I mean, we could go around in circles for a long time on that, but
that's super interesting.
Well, Sarah, you reference in a lot of ways, this kind of is very similar to discourses on the South, right? Where we think about Old South, Native South, New South. And Sarah, you know, as I was reading your work, you know, you talk about discourses on new Western history. So I was kind of thinking, you know, one of the questions I often think about in terms of the West is when is the West? Because referencing a new Western history kind of implies that there's an older Western and a newer Western. What do those divisions look like? Do those happen, say, after 1890? When's the old and when's the new West?
The West ends when Elsa dies.
Oh, the West ends in season one.
Do you know what I think, though? Yeah, Josh, I think that could be like one way to read it. And then I was also thinking
it's the innocence
that when she dies, it means the West can live forever because she's all like her like moment of life is only on the journey. And there's all this foreshadowing of how once the journey's over, she won't be able to be this figure anymore. But because she dies at the end of the journey, then her life is confined to her, you know, Western experience. And I think you're absolutely right that this idea that the West doesn't really exist is actually what makes it powerful. That it's this idea that there is the West, that the public, you know, holds on to these 19th century icons of the West in U.S. history that makes it so powerful and makes like the work you've done, Joss, with Imagined West and your book, like so important.
Thank you. No, that's totally smart.
Well, can we talk a little bit about that? Because, you know, Josh, you do so much about the idea of what is a Western, right? And one of the things that studying film over the course of the development of HATM has done is really informed me about how we understand so much of American past vis-a-vis pop culture, via film. I know that my earliest perceptions of the West were informed from a couch in Western Kentucky sitting next to my grandfather watching the Western Channel, because that's what he wanted to watch, and all I wanted to do was sit next to him. So I watched it too, right? And that's what informed. So I had this very romantic idea of the West and, you know, the lone gunman, the lady of ill repute who he's in love with, all the different aspects, all these tropes. Can we talk a little bit about, before we jump into 1883, about what is a Western?
Yeah, I mean, sure. I was kind of coming into the Autry, which is defined as a museum of the American West. That museum was kind of not wanting to take a side about whether the West was like this 19th century moment, this, you know, late 19th century, you know, 1840, whatever, to 1890 or 1900, somewhere in there, or whether it includes like a lot. I think for a lot of the public, there is a sense that the West is like going out to Joshua Tree now, right? And or like just doing hiking, or there's another version of the West that's contemporary that the public has too, right? Of the West as a contemporary place. It's got beautiful national parks. It's got, it's a less, even so, even now, I think people kind of feel like a little less socially constrained maybe in the, than if they were from the East Coast, or maybe they're from another country, that the Western United States has a little bit more flexibility in terms of your self-identification or something. But then there's this other idea of the West that kind of ends in 1900 or something, or in Frederick Jackson Turner's case, 1890. But so I was kind of playing with that and, you know, and just kind of not want, like the prior to me being there, there was sort of like, The film series was kind of like Westerns from about Stagecoach, 1939, you know, to Unforgiven, basically 1992, right? And then it was kind of like, I mean, there were a few exceptions here and there, but that was kind of the canon. But now we're moving, it's been like 30, whatever the math is, 30 some years since Unforgiven. And there have been all these other ones, and there's a lot more play in these. And I guess this kind of comes, I ended up using as a kind of shorthand for this, that perhaps before Yellowstone phenomenon, at least, the biggest Western of the past 25 years is the Toy Story series. And that was useful for me at the museum to sort of say, look, it has a cowboy. It has, you know, it has this kind of thing, but it also has a spaceman. And also this family lives vaguely in California too, in the contemporary California. And so it's the West as this contemporary place that's just a section of this nation, and then the West with this kind of hero's journey. But there's also the spaceman, right? That's the and all the and the slinky dog and all this other stuff. And so Toy Story was a really useful shorthand for me in terms of making the case that there was a broader range of Westerns than that sort of John Wayne to Clint Eastwood arc. Partly just so I didn't get bored.
Well, look, I'm out here in Colorado. We've got dinosaur tracks, so it works with the dinosaur in sure. in Toy Story as well. Like, and we've got T-Rex tracks all over what Utah and Montana's. So, you know, I'm down for that.
Yeah, totally. There's this movie called The Valley of Gwangi. Do you know?
No,
it's a
no,
1960s early claymation. Well, it has claymation in a live action film, and so it's like cowboys fighting with dinosaurs. So definitely add that to your watch list.
I feel like that's a metaphor for historiography right now, but you know, we can get into that a little bit later on as we enter into hour 7 of this podcast. So you guys want to jump into 1883 and kind of give some first riffs on this? Josh, you had never seen this before either, correct?
No,
before
I
we
hadn't.
Before we did this podcast, you both seen it now. What are your first takes on Taylor Sheridan's 1883? What are your thoughts? Had you seen Yellowstone, and what were your thoughts on 1883?
For me, this was my first introduction to Taylor Sheridan's work. Like, I'd heard about Yellowstone. My department chair, who always recommends the best shows, had told me to watch it, and I did not heed his advice. So I was a little late to the party. But I started watching 1883, and right from the beginning, I was so engaged. And I wanted to find out what happened next. And I found it was so engrossing because every twist and turn, well, most of the twists and turns were things that I'd considered or analyzed in my book and that are really so central to the trail experience from the mid-19th century forwards. We have the fear of disease and checking people for smallpox. We have people getting cholera and learning they should boil the water, which they know kind of by 1883. They didn't know in the mid-19th century when most of my folks traveled. So to me, I just want to say, what is he going to bring in next? And how is he going to present all of these things that I've read in the historical record and thought about and written about for so long?
Yeah. I can't remember. I saw Wind River. That's Taylor Sheridan, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very dark, disturbing film.
Yes, very disturbing. And I've had some, I've heard from Native folks, both loving and hating that movie for a variety of reasons. Cause it's sort of a attempt to bring the missing and murdered Indigenous women issue to a broad audience, but some saw it as almost pornographic in its violence and stuff. And so, I mean, it's complicated. And So I'd seen that. I don't think I saw Hell or High Water. I hadn't seen any of the Yellowstone universe. I knew I should see it, but I just never got to it. I'm just too busy. And it's so daunting to see a series like that. That's so many seasons and you're just where can I really take this on? So I hadn't. So my first impression, and this is, I just came back from a family trip to Brazil. My first impression is that this is a telenovela. It's an American telenovela. It's basically that it is super amped up, melodramatic, tearjerker, high drama. And I'm depending on my mood, I'm kind of either there for that or not. I'm kind of sometimes just rolling my eyes and sometimes engrossed. So I'm kind of it just kind of depends on whether I'm really willing to suspend disbelief sort of, you know, and partly that's probably just history, studying too much history, right? So
Well, sure. I mean, ultimately, it's a drama, right? It's going to be it's expected to be dramatic and like over the top at times, right? And before we dive in too deeper, I meant to ask this a little bit earlier, but Sarah, if we could talk a little bit real quick, you mentioned the Overland Trail experience. I know that a lot of people coming to this really kind of becomes aware of this trail, certainly through Oregon Trail. We'll talk about the game here a little bit later on. There's no way we can not talk about that part of our lives. But can you talk a little bit about what the Overland Trail is? Is there one trail? Because I know the answer to this, but can you talk to me and the rest of our audience about what this Overland Trails are and when those trails existed?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's a lot of different trails across the continent. So for example, in 1883, I don't know if it says exactly where they leave from, but they go from Texas and then they head north through Indian Territory or Oklahoma and get into Wyoming and then Montana. And when I think about the Overland Trail, when I use that term in the book, it's really to bring together all these multiple routes where people are having a similarly dramatic journey. And in my book, I'm specifically focused on the journey from the eastern United States to the Pacific coast, because that has a particular cultural salience that you're going to make it all the way across the continent to the ocean. And we see that in 1883 too, you know, one of the final episodes, we do have that shot of the ocean. So I use the term Overland Trail to bring all those together because they have a similar cultural resonance. And then when folks ask me, well, you're doing the Oregon or the California trails, I say, no, both. They say, well, which parts are you doing? You're doing the Snake River portion. I like that part. And I'm like, nope, all of it. So that's why I used Overland Trail. Yeah.
And like, I don't want to be like a historian pedant, but like, was I correct in watching this and being like, oh, he's kind of like mixing some different time periods. Like some of this feels like it's really in the 1840s or 1850s. And then some is more like 1880s. Like there's a kind of like in total giving him his dramatic license to do that. But just like from that perspective, was I right in thinking like some of this feels like it's like a kind of mixing of a few different decades of type of experiences in one drama?
Yeah, I'd say I would agree with you. And I don't know, Josh, how you felt about this, but I was confused as to why they were in Casper and then talking about going on to Laramie when they were going to Oregon, because Casper was kind of up in the center and Laramie's a little bit farther south and they were heading north. So there were a few things I got where I was like, what's happening? But I think Taylor Sheridan could have done a couple series on the trail experience and we could have had the classic mid-19th century, basically, you know, his cinematic version of the Oregon Trail game, perhaps with some new twists. And instead, we're just stuck in 1883. And I think there's things about that make this show really, really good that we're in the post-Civil War period. And I think, like you said, Josh, there's other things where I'm like, if we could parse these experiences a little bit more, then we'd get more of that complexity of the trail journey and the trail experience and one that's more sort of tied in time as well as in place, because they'd be going across different places, likely, hopefully.
Right. Like he needs the Civil War to be in the background, but he also needs like there to be covered wagons and not like the railroad is kind of a little bit alluded to, but not really an option for these folks, right?
Yeah.
And
I think that works in some ways because people like these German immigrants who are, you know, sort of they make up the bulk, the majority of the characters, even though most of them are pretty one-dimensional. Those type of folks, they really might not have been able to afford a train ticket. So you will still have some wagon travel in the 1880s. But I think you're right, Josh, too, that these references to the railroad, the passing reference to barbed wire, like this is very Turnerian, a West that's going to be over by 1890. Like these things are coming and it's going to change things dramatically. So he gets to do kind of that dying of the West, even as he's exploring, you know, this adventuresome journey through it.
Yeah. Setting this in 1883 allows him to do that, right? Because like you were saying, Sarah, you know, you're probably not going to get a couple series out of this where people are like, oh, I want to see the West in 1842 or something like that.
I do, but
lines,
not
right?
Lots of people.
Right? But a post-Civil War West allows you to do tell a lot of different stories. Certainly, you know, a friend of the pod, Megan Kate Nelson, has talked a lot about this in her own work, about how the West, you know, expand. You know, as we think about the war continually expands to the West. When we think about the Civil War. It allows us maybe in some ways, do you guys think about this? Like in terms of, you know, our main protagonist, James, the Tim McGraw character, he's a Confederate veteran of the war, right? But it's set far enough removed from the war that maybe some ways you're able to like almost, you know, sympathize with the course. Of course, he was captured in Antietam. He spent the war as a prisoner of war. Like he's tweaking this to allow you to, as best you can, sympathize with a guy who fought for slavery and against the United States and all of these different things, right? I mean, so you're able to do some different stuff. Saying and again, like you were just talking about, capture this Turnerian dying of the West or changing of the West or something along those lines.
Yeah, that part like bugs me, even though, and I'm sorry, I know you're a Southerner and Southern historian, but I'm like, oh, of course the superhero family in this, like the real people have to be Southerners. And it kind of, that tradition goes back to the Virginian, and, you know, I know Heather Cox Richardson has written about this, that in a sense, like the West gets, even though probably a large, Sarah, you can tell us if the, like, a lot of people were coming from the North too, right? Like in, but of course the heroes, the default cowboy has to actually be a Southerner, right? And that, yeah, like the Virginian is the same thing. The first kind of Western novel in a lot of ways is like, it's about like transporting this Southern honor into a new context and kind of like eliding the whole part about slavery and stuff.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think both of you have drawn us something that's really important in the series, but might not stand out immediately because it is so much about this going West adventure, right? And sort of, that's part of the mythology of the West that does the work, or at least the imagined work of reunification and reconciliation after the Civil War, is we can all be Americans again out here together, right? And I think there's that really telling exchange when Tim McGraw's character tells the captain, played by Sam Elliott, doing an amazing job as always, that he basically says, owns up and says he's a Confederate veteran. And Sam Elliott, who's a Union veteran, is just like, okay, like if I remember it correctly, like he doesn't even have a flicker of displeasure on his face. So that's one of the things that bugged me about the series too. It's really undergirding this sort of white supremacist narrative post-Civil War is we can just all be Americans again together, at least in that sense.
Though it's interesting in the history of that trajectory by like, okay, we're going to include one black character. We're going to have the European immigrant story, which actually typically that's a pretty unusual thing in Westerns. I have not seen that many Westerns with the kind of European migrants experience and so on. So there's an effort to update that, but to kind of like smooth over anything about it, like that Tim McGraw doesn't, or their whole family, the Dutton family, doesn't really indicate any sort of racism. And maybe they weren't, maybe they were they were the Tennesseans who weren't racist. That's
Here's what I think is interesting about this whole settler discourse that we're going on, you know. And Sarah, you really led to this in your own book, where you talk about how for the longest time we talk about in American history the idea that slavery is the great sin of American history. But as you know, you talk about that doesn't, slavery can't expand without indigenous dispossession. And I'm not here to compare one to the other because they're both awful. Right. But this movement West is so much about indigenous dispossession. At the same time, it's almost like you've got this micro history in 1883 because, you know, as historians, we kind of get this bird's eye view of history. And of course, we have the liberty of looking back. Right. I kept thinking over the weekend as I was as we were in San Francisco for the American Historical Association conference. I love film and things like that. And I love time travel movies. So I'm like, wait, we have time travel. They're called books. Right. I mean, that's what time travel is. Right. The best books are time travel. You can go back and live that experience. But, you know, as historians, we can often go back and say, oh, this settler colonial history, it was this big thing that was taking place. And yet at the same time, the thing that I really enjoy about the series, what I thought was really interesting, at least as a scholar, was that seeing the experiences of, say, these German and Romanian settlers and so forth, was that when they are traveling cross country, they are not conceptualizing themselves as taking part in this great act of dispossession. Now, they were certainly participants in that, right? But they were just trying to survive like another day. So one of the things I think this thing does really well is the idea is like, oh, we can get inside the lived experience of all of these people who were just trying to live day to day and see how that process expands. I mean, and you're right, Josh. I've never seen that German experience on the plains before, but if you go anywhere in Denver, everything is German. You know, it's like that experience is there.
Yeah, super interesting. And I had to look. I was like, are there Roma people moving into the American West in the 19th century? And it's like, sure enough, who knew? I never read anything about that. And it's like, and that they were not a united, right? Like that they were like, we were just all on the same boat together, right? Like that. So there's an interesting metaphorical kind of population of that sort of, there's no kind of really coherent, cohesive community. Really, like it has to be sort of forged through this settler experience, right? Like, and I think that the settler colonial thing is interesting, like, and to Sarah's scholarship, I mean, it's like if they suffer enough, then it's like they own the land, like they have a right to the land, right? In a sense that like, if you have to amputate your leg, then you have earned your settler status, right? You've earned a certain kind of indigeneity or something in a sense.
I wonder if we can talk for a little bit of a second. You know, you both talk about the idea of this West is this new beginning, in a lot of ways, new beginning for the United States. Out West, we can move past the sins of slavery and past the war, quite literally, where we've got Northern and Southern. We've got African-Americans there and things like that. We've got Shay, however, who is looking for an ending to his life, as we know Samuel L.'s character is brilliantly portrayed by in that film. Can we talk about why people are leaving Europe and how dangerous this is just to get here? Because I keep thinking as we watch the show and all these people, you guys watch Star Trek? Because it felt like every German on this show should have been wearing a red jacket, a red coat or something like that, because they were going to die on the show at some point in time. This was such an arduous journey, and that's just from Texas to Oregon, let alone getting
to Wyoming, really, to like, yeah, Texas, right? To Wyoming, right? It's just one by one. Like I thought there was going to be a little higher survival rate.
No, it turns out no. Don't get comfortable if you're just now coming to this show. Don't get comfortable with anyone on this show. It's not happy, right? But what are the push factors forcing people to flee Europe, cross an ocean, get to a coast, find their way to Texas, and then up and over to the West Coast? What is pushing people? What is so awful about Europe in the 19th century that is making people flee in these kinds of numbers and take these risks where they know families are not going to survive?
I think this connects a little bit back to the point that Josh made about the Black character in the show. And it's a really good example of the complexity that Sheridan brings to the series in showcasing the degrees of freedom that people have, right? So we see that with the African-American character, and then we also see it with these German immigrants, where for them, the chance to get land and have that property ownership is seen as so much better for them than the situation they were in Europe. And so, yeah, they're willing to throw in and risk this journey.
Well, how do you kind of gauge the mortality rate on this particular train versus the median in your research, Sarah? I don't know if there's any way to actually definitively say that, but it was like pretty severe.
Very high. Yeah.
Okay.
Which is typical of, you know, these sort of cinematic depictions of the trail, and was also partly typical because that's what people imagined and said and wrote for centuries, both during the trail experience and after. A really exaggeration of the numbers as far as we can tell. And like you're saying, Josh, that had a particular power to it in terms of sacrifices of the journey and then imagining the West as white American land rather than native land, right? The sort of sacralization of the land, claiming of space through these dead people who had suffered to try to get to the promise and opportunity of the West.
Sarah, so much of your work revolves around death, and so much of the show revolves around creative ways in which people die. Can you talk a little bit about how people are dying on this trail, like the ways that you encountered in your research and what we saw in the show? Is this accurate? Do people get bit in the bum by a rattlesnake and die? I mean,
it's possible.
What happens when you got to go number one on the trail?
They don't talk a lot about that, though. Obviously, we know they were doing it, right? And, you know, like the way most people died in the 19th century, even the way most people died during the Civil War, it's disease. By 1883, right, we're getting more progress in terms of science and how to combat things like cholera. But particularly in the mid-19th century, they don't know what to wash their hands. There's not a lot of vaccines. And, you know, we don't have antibiotics. So, yeah, it's mostly disease. Accidents, you know, rattlesnake getting you while you're going to the bathroom. Yeah, that could count as an accident.
The wagon wheel running over you, that one, that was a gruesome one.
Yep, that could definitely happen. I mean, these are 2,000 plus pound wagons, right? And these are wooden wheels encased in iron. Yeah, definitely could be fatal. They do a really good job depicting the dangers of crossing rivers and how much work it took. And so that I thought was really well done, because drownings are definitely a big factor.
Yeah, you know, I remember as a kid, okay, we're going to talk about Oregon Trail, start working this into there, because like I remember it's like, oh, okay, we have to ford the river. Oh, we lost a couple pounds of flour or whatever, mm-hmm. right? And this show really goes, I mean, so I remember the very first episodes, it was like, okay, we made it to a river. And like this river crossing becomes like a theme. It's like every time you get to a river, it's a moment of like real consideration. Like, what do we do about this? You know, do we go to another crossing? Do we take our chances? We know we're going to lose some people when we cross this river. I mean, it is a real, these river crossings are terrifying mm-hmm. in 1883, are they not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. You know, and depending on the river crossing, there's a little bit more infrastructure even in the mid-19th century than they show in 1883, because you have, you know, people who are running ferries, you pay them. I'm not saying it was easy, but I'm saying that, you know, especially over time and the amount of people that travel these trails, even just in the mid-19th century, you're talking over 250,000 people. There's a little bit of support there. But yeah, you're still going to have to make these tough choices, and a lot of people can't swim or they can't swim very well. Things aren't necessarily going to go their way.
I want to ask you guys about how people are getting across this trail. First and foremost, the trails themselves, are these white American and Europeans, are they forging their own trails? Are these trails being co-opted from pre-existing indigenous travel paths that people are using to go east, west, and so forth, before these settlers arrive? And then also about the roles of Native folks themselves. Like, so we see indigenous communities throughout this series. We see very first episode. I mean, the very first moments of this show are Lakota really contesting these settlers being on their lands. Mm-hmm. So can we talk a little bit about the varying ways in which Native people encountered these settlers as they crossed through, say, Comancheria, Lakota lands, so forth on these trails?
Do you want me to talk about the roots a little bit?
Talk about the roots, and then we'll get into the relationships along the roots, because these people certainly were not getting there all by their lonesome.
No, for sure. And you know, there's not a lot of book reading in 1883, but they would have had books with them, and they would have had guidebooks. Or in 1883, they have a guide who's done it before or read the books, right? So there's a lot of information out there. It doesn't mean it's accurate, but it exists. And
the internet.
Yeah.
they have memes.
Yeah. But Jason, when we met about 10 years ago, we were in Michigan at the Clements Library. And one of the things I was reading a lot of there was all of these books that were published by earlier explorers like John Charles Fremont, right? Who goes in the early 1840s. And Fremont's mapping and cartography of this route is, you know, very much indebted to indigenous peoples that he meets. And encounters on the trail. So I think that can kind of answer your question about this route and how much it existed beforehand. And then Fremont, in part because his narrative is so well written and exciting, you know, his wife helped him. Everybody buys his book, and they often have that on the trail. So they're going in Fremont's footsteps. They want to experience the same things that he does. They want to follow his route. And, you know, they want to participate in this romanticization of the West, which they know at the time is a constructed thing. You know, Fremont has this really evocative passage about pausing to have a buffalo hunt on the plains and how authentic this is. We get that in 1883 too. Josh, do you want to jump in on Native encounters?
Well, yeah. I mean, on the, I was thinking about this just in terms of the history of Native people in Hollywood cinema. I think it's doing some good things, surprise. He definitely is really careful to sort of not portray Native people as kind of one-dimensional savages or a sort of impediment to civilization or whatever. However, many, 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 many hundreds of movies have done, right? For whatever, I'm sure you could pick lots of parts of it apart, but I mean, it was pretty interesting, and that there's like three distinct tribes that they kind of encounter and kind of talk with, of Comanche first, and then Lakota, and then Apsalika Crow. You know, some of them speak English, some don't. Like, there's just some interesting things. I mean, there's lots of historical inaccuracies, I'm sure, but especially in terms of what's going on in 1883 by that point. But I was, you know, kind of pleasantly surprised by the portrayals of Native people in the show. Personally, I don't know what your reactions were to that aspect, but they're sort of portrayed sympathetically, but not too, a little romantically, but not too much. And I don't know. What did you all think?
I think that's sort of Sheridan's intent, and I think that he was mostly successful at it. Sorry, I'm going to bring up the buffalo hunt scene again, but which I think is like towards the end of the series. But I thought he did this really purposeful, smart thing where he, you know, he was shooting it up, and you see Sam, who's the Comanche character, you see his face, you know, come up over the edge of the cliff, and he's looking down at the buffalo. And for a moment, to me, it looked like a recreation of these old, really racist, stereotypical Westerns, where there's always a shot of these one-dimensional, supposedly, you know, Indian characters who are sneaking up on a wagon train, right? And they're about to shoot it down. And so he has Sam's face come over. I'm like, whoa, that's almost a recreation of those old scenes. And then Elsa, who's the white teenage female character who has this very Ternarian Western awakening on the journey, her head comes up next to him. And I'm like, well, that's different. And I think that was really intentional. And I think that's a really good example of Sheridan knowing his stuff. Like, he knows what he's doing. But I think Josh is right that there is a good development of Native characters. There's not a good development of the systemic forces of colonialism and oppression and the military that have wreaked havoc against Native homelands and Native nations and peoples since the beginning of the United States, and by 1883 have grown in their power, and that's absent.
Right, like there's no reservation. I mean, they allude a couple times to a reservation, but at this point, it's like a lot of these tribes are basically in prison camps, yeah. Right? Like, and so like the fact that they're out, it seems really. But again, I think this might be a place where he is sort of eliding these decades a little bit, mm-hmm. too, where he's kind of trying to have an 1850s moment and an 1880s moment in the same
kind of trying to tell him almost like a synthetic story. It's just a bit trying to tell this larger story that, again, you're not going to get 100% accuracy in anything.
And he seems to be trying to allude to the Sand Creek Massacre with that one, in a smaller scale, in that one, in that late kind of massacre, though. Mm-hmm. I don't know, because then it's not like a militia per se, though. It's just these outlaws, right? So that you're right that like the federal government's, the military's presence attacking Native people is pretty absent.
Well, can we talk about the outlaws? Because the outlaws are a big part of this story. I wasn't expecting so much outlaw in this series, and I'm kind of wondering, Sarah, do you come across this very often in your research where people are getting killed because of bandits? And I had no idea that this was gonna be so much of a problem, where there were just these renegade dudes, you know. I mean, these guys are like, I don't know, grasslands pirates is what it feels like.
Yeah, I mean, again, like numbers, it's hard to measure, right? But yeah, people talk about it. And there's instances, for example, where they, these white immigrants who have been primed to see Native people as, you know, liable to attack them at any moment, come up on a dead person or see a grave and think they've been killed by Indians. Sometimes they do a little bit of investigating, maybe dig up the corpse or look for evidence. And when they find things like, you know, bullet wounds or knife wounds or whatever that they think look like things that white bandits would use, they say, oh, it was actually a bandit, right? Or vice versa. We know, and I think this is one of the things 1883 does a good job with. I mean, Native people had guns, right? There's no reason why they would be stuck with other weapons. They use a multitude of weaponry in the series. But yeah, there's bandits out and about on the trail. And, you know, both in terms of threat to life and threat of sexual violence, which comes up in 1883 too, it's definitely a distinct possibility. There are these bad actors who sometimes try to make it look like other people did the bad things, including Native people.
I'm kind of wondering, Josh, maybe we can kind of jump into this idea about how, and Sarah and I have kind of talked about this beforehand a little bit over at AHA when we were there over the weekend in the West, which is in San Francisco. but this idea,
we made
now,
it to the Pacific.
We did. I went to the Pacific and I talked to the sea lions, which is actually, I don't know if it comes across in the archives, Sarah, but that's actually a reason why people were going to the West. There are no sea lions in Germany, it turns out. So all of this stuff is because people wanted to pat the marine life on the head. and then they could go. But I'm wondering, you know, Josh, you alluded to Unforgiven, which I think comes out, what, early 90s, 92, 93,
yeah,
somewhere in that
I
range?
Think about 92. And
Unforgiven is part of this, part of these films that are coming out. Last of the Mohicans, obviously Dances, Far and Away. There is a slew of films. There's Resurrection. Lonesome Dove is on right around that time period. And now here we are 30-some-odd years later, and Yellowstone, obviously 1883, 1923, and we've got all these other films and things like. Are we in the middle of like a new age of Westerns? And if so, why? What is this sudden shift towards attention to the West again? Why are we talking about this? Sarah, you know, Josh, what do you guys think?
No, it's a good question because I feel, well, one thing I kind of learned over the course of like reading about Westerns and stuff is that there have been multiple times when people are like, the genre is done, it's played out. Like in the 20s, it happened, you know, and then it gets sort of reinvented in sound film with the Singing Cowboys or something. And then there's this sort of epic era of the 40s and 50s of these kind of John Ford-esque type movies. And then there's sort of people keep finding ways to reinvent it. So I think there are sort of peaks and valleys, but it doesn't ever, it like people always sort of think it's dying, but it doesn't ever actually die as a genre.
It's like, exactly.
But I think, yeah, you're right that there was this moment in the late 80s, early 90s. And like, I saw part of Lonesome Dove and I was like, this is a lot. This owes a lot to Lonesome Dove, if I remember correctly, because I think that this is, and that was a miniseries too, and so on. And those ones you mentioned that were, you know, there were no Westerns won Best Picture at the Oscars, I think, from like the 30s all the way until the sort of Dances with Wolves and Unforgiven moment. Some actors did here or there, but a film, they weren't taken seriously. It was like, you wouldn't give a Best Picture to a Marvel movie, you know, you wouldn't, you kind of, it wasn't considered serious or whatever. But now it does seem like there has been, there is a resurgence. I mean, and it has all these different, like that Power of the Dog won the Oscar a few years ago, and that was a very different Western. There have been just so many. So why? That's a good question. I mean, is there something about like a culture, moments of cultural crisis or something that, it, you know, in the same way, like Phil DeLoria talks about playing Indian as like this solution to cultural crises of certain moments. Is there a certain way in which Westerns are a way to sort of deal with national identity or in moments of crisis? I mean, we could hypothesize about that maybe. I don't know. What do you all think?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting to think about. We could overstate the power of our profession and say that this surge of Westerns is all because of the vibrancy of the field of Western history and it's inspiring all these new shows and movies that center different characters and see the West as a much more diverse place where people with very different identities could find their place. I think there might be a little bit of that, but I think that's overstating something that's seeping up in general in U.S. politics and culture right now, is this drive to really redefine, you know, who's at the center of American society, who's at the center of American history. And I think the West is this genre that's always been wrapped up with national identity. And as Josh pointed out, American exceptionalism, even though this story gets played out around the globe, I think it's a fertile field for people to stake their claim to the West in a cultural, metaphorical way, in the ways that Joseph and the Duttons and Thomas staked their claim for real in the West in 1883 at the end.
And just thinking how, like, Beyonce has really used Western imagery a lot, and the explosion of that Lil Nas X song a few years ago, and like the symbol of the cowboy, to claim that identity as a cowboy is like, is still powerful, right? Like, it still has cultural salience, which in some ways you'd think it would be played out, right? That it would feel kind of retro, but, or like the 50s or something, but people keep finding ways to sort of, it just has, you know, if you ask somebody from some country, any country around the world, like what's an American, what's a typical American, or like a caricature of an American, they'd probably say a cowboy, right?
Yeah, my understanding is actually in Japanese cinema and Japanese culture, and I know certainly in German culture, the West is very prevalent in the mind's eye of what American or American history is. Obviously, there are lots of different. I can only imagine having this conversation in, you know, Tokyo or something like that. What's the West? It'd probably give us a much. I would actually love to hear an outside opinion as far as what is the American one. Yeah, absolutely. I think. I think this actually goes into a lot of the historical discourse that we have right now, if I may, which is right now history itself seems to be embroiled in battles over who can and cannot tell certain types of histories. And I certainly, for me, I think there's lots of benefits from telling histories from within and also from without. All we're trying to do is get these perspectives. I remember one of the great things, one of my professors actually at Wichita State, George Diener, who does environmental history, once told me, he was like, you're not trying to be right or wrong. Ultimately, all you're trying to do is add to the argument. And I remember that took a lot of the weight off my shoulders as a scholar, certainly as I was writing my dissertation. And now as I'm starting to revise that into my own book, is go, okay, all I'm trying to do is just give some thoughts here, right? But yeah, sorry, that's a little diatribe that I keep thinking about. But yeah.
Yeah. No, but I think that's really true about what we do as historian. I think it connects to what Josh said about the cowboy figure. Doesn't feel retro. It feels new and modern. It's being used in new ways. Just like as historians, you know, we're having a conversation and we keep adding to that conversation. And so we're going to bring up familiar topics like the cowboy or the Overland Trail, but we'll talk about them in new ways, add on, and then go on from there. Keep rolling with it.
Wasn't that what Power of the Dog does so well? Is take this well-written trope of like the West and a cowboy and inject this whole idea of sexuality into it that really we hadn't seen in a large format. Was like, wait a second, there are, you know, homosexual cowboys. Of course there are, right? Of course, right? It's Brokeback Mountain did that so well.
Yeah.
A new Western did that amazingly well. I think that's part of these conversations we can have. Mm-hmm. Do you see that also in the histories, Sarah, as far as like, do people start to circle back? You know, you're writing this new history of this Overland Trail, first book on it in some, 40 years, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
What was that like for you to as you came to identify this, as you started to conceptualize what your project was going to be? It's like, okay, nobody's written about this in four decades. We got to go back and talk about this now. Was that like an aha moment when you were like, wait a second, there's nothing here, nothing new here? Or were you scared shitless? Like, how does that happen for a scholar when you're like, ha-ha, oh, crap, I'm an island? Like, what happens for you?
Yeah, so there's been no, like, major reinterpretation of the trail. But I think also, and Jason and Josh are both so aware of this because of the spaces you're working in. But people are still really enthralled with the narrative and the sources. And so we've seen some progress, right, in terms of, for example, diversifying the actors on the trail, like more research for the National Park Service and other folks on, you know, African-American experiences, the experience of Native peoples, not just as encountering the Westward Movement, but participating in the Westward Movement. You know, Cherokee people are a great example of this. So there continue to be like little things like that. But yeah, Jason, like for like mainstream academic historians in the scholarly field, they might say, like Josh would say, you know, why are you working on this retro cowboy thing? But it keeps coming back in new ways, kind of a thing. And I kind of like that as a little bit of a challenge, even though sometimes it was a little, I felt a little undermined by people's comments. But honestly, it goes back to what we need from history is we need sources. And the Overland Trail sources, there's so many of them, and they're so rich for mining new material, new perspectives, right? Different gender identities, all of these things that I was confident they wouldn't let me down.
I mean, this is a little of an aside, but I'm curious, like when you were talking about, oh, our field, you know, contributing to this pop culture resurgence, and sort of noticing though at like the Western History Association meeting, it seems like there's less and less, even 19th century history there, let alone like earlier, that there are very few panels on these kinds of topics. And I'm guilty of this myself and working mostly in 20th century history in my own academic research. And so, but yeah, that I think I've heard people observe this, and sort of your topic maybe in some ways got caught up in that there's some sort of, we need to almost rediscover the 19th century as a topic.
Yeah. And when I was thinking about historians' influence on, you know, this resurgence or potential influence on this resurgence, you know, I think it could be like this, you know, delayed response to the 90s and the early 2000s, right? Because I absolutely agree with you, Josh, that our field, and I don't know if Jason, this is true for your field as well, but we're, and for good reason, like it's 2020, I was going to say it's 2023, it's 2024, right? Like moving forward in time is important. Like our undergraduate students and our high school students, like they are 21st century folks. So yeah, we need to get there. But I mean, I'm always going to be connected to the 19th century West, and I hope more people do work on it too, because I think it's important. And I think it's important not only because it's this time period that precedes, it's really a time period where we can see things like Native power operating very strongly. We can see moments to push back at the, you know, the idea that there was something inevitable about U.S. expansion, because it just wasn't. And I also think that because these cultural icons of the cowboy and the wagon and even the railroad persist, that the more we can revisit them to re-understand them, the better we're going to understand our more contemporary presence or contemporary past, excuse me, and our presence. So.
No, I totally get you, Sarah. Like, and for, you know, for my own work in Florida, so much I started to read in the West to start to rethink what Florida is in the 18th, early 19th centuries, you know? And I think a lot of the processes that you start to see, say, that are demonstrated in 1883, we actually see in Florida much earlier, as far as certainly governmental policy. And a lot of the actors who are on stage in what we've considered the West, you know, guys like Sherman and so forth, you know, really kind of cut their teeth in Florida. You know, I see him in Fort Lauderdale in 1841, and there he is, you know, talking to Kawakachee. You know, he's got those relationships. So it's really started to get me thinking about maybe we can tell a Western history of Florida and kind of borrowing from that, which is kind of perfect for those of you attending the Western and Southern conferences in Kansas City later this year. I want to ask you guys about your own scholarship, if I may. Certainly, the two of you have published your reading all the time. I'm sure you're thinking about maybe your next projects or the things that you do. What are the books, what are the works, maybe three or four books that, you know, in your own mind's eye, you think, wow, this is something that really influenced me to get to where I'm at now. What are, you know, a couple, three, four books that really got you thinking about what it is that you do?
Mm-hmm. I want Josh to go first because I really want to hear what he says. Putting you on the spot.
Well, on these Western topics of Western, and I'm not typically like a literary theory type person or anything, but I really found helpful there's a British scholar, I think, named Neil Campbell, and he wrote a couple books about the sort of image of the West. One, but the one that was most helpful for me was called the Rhizomatic West. And using this sort of, I think it's like post-structuralist sort of idea of the rhizome in narrative, and that it's kind of everywhere and nowhere all at once. It's like the difference, just to explain a rhizome for, because I don't know, some people are into theory and some people aren't, but like a tree is like an arborescent narrative, is like a, you know, so-and-so begat so-and-so, a sort of linear narrative, and rhizome is like grass, like just kind of, there's no trunk, right? There's no single thing. And sort of he follows icons of the West into transnational spaces, kind of like the German and Japanese things you're talking about, or into kind of unexpected places. I ended up, you know, the big thing that I worked on at the Autry was reinterpreting the permanent gallery on Western storytelling, and that includes the Western genre, but other stories. And like the international Westerns was a really interesting sort of thing to work on. We ended up creating this touch screen that had a world map and about 40 countries highlighted, where here's an instance of Western mythology there. And that could range from like how Theodore Roosevelt used the Rough Riders in Cuba in sort of American imperialism, to a youth movement in Congo in the 1950s, dressing up as cowboys in a sort of resistance to Belgian colonialism, right? Like there's all these facets, and it can be used in many, many ways. And so I think that Rhizomatic West kind of helped me think through this kind of West that kind of is not a single tradition in that sense. And then my great sort of, for my own research, I'm, as I said, I'm doing 20th century Native American history in my dissertation, and then I'm trying to revise that into a book now. That's about Native sound media in the 20th century, mostly from, or starting in 1890s, but in mostly in the 20th century. And Phil DeLoria's Indians in Unexpected Places is like, I mean, I have to even tone down my phone fanboyness on that book.
No, I fanboyed all over Dan Flores in the current episode.
Yeah, right, yeah. Okay.
This is a pro fanboy, safe fanboy space here. So, Deloria, how you doing? I am also a fanboy. Go on. Sorry. So Indians in Unexpected Places, you were saying?
Yeah. I mean, just because that I found, you know, if you look at like a lot of American history textbooks, the Native history basically disappears after Wounded Knee, and then might reappear in Red Power maybe for a minute as part of the post civil rights era and stuff, but really that those years in between are a lot of scholars have worked on it, but especially on boarding schools and a few other topics, but the early 20th century is sort of still, it needs to break through at least to a wider audience. You know, I know scholars have been working in that area in various topics, but to think through that area and what that era and how Native people responded to the 20th century and created modernity in the 20th century, and in the face of expectations of their non-modernity, it was just so helpful for me in terms of thinking through that era. So those are some of my greatest hits that I can think of at the moment. Sarah?
Yeah. So earlier I was really aggressive in that I thought the West exists, and I said I'm a Western historian, or I always will be, 19th century forever. But when thinking about my answer to this question, the first two books that always come to mind for me are not Westerns. And they come to mind for me because I really started, and I think I'm still learning, but I really started to understand what history is and what historians do when I was an undergraduate. And two of the first books that I read have been so influential to me in that understanding and also in my interest in cultural history. And the first of these is Walter Johnson's Soul by Soul. So you guys know this one, right? So the explication of the horrors of the slave market in New Orleans, but not only the horrors, also how enslaved people responded to and combated this attempt to transform people into products or people into prices. And I And I remember reading that and just thinking, wow, like this is what history can do. And like you're saying, Josh, about theory, like there's so much theory behind that. But then when you read it, it's really just showcasing people's actions and people's experiences. So that blew my mind. Around the same time, I also read Jill Lepore's Name of War.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Jason, do you like that one? Because I know, you know, people have differing opinions on.
It's actually my favorite work that Jill has done. I don't know Jill Lepore, whatever. Jill, if you're out there, what's up? You know, I read Jill Lepore. I read Name of War and Comanche and Pocahontas, the Comanche Empire in the same class at Wichita State. And those were two foundational works that really kind of got me thinking about doing Native history as a career. I think they're both Jill and Pekka are amazing wordsmiths, as is Walter Johnson, by the way. Yeah. Was it River of Dark Dreams I read? Kirsten Fisher, I don't know if you know her work, had us read River of Dark Dreams at Minnesota when I was doing graduate school. And all I could think was, holy shitballs, this man can write. So, I mean, oh my gosh, I really liked what I dug about Jill Lepore's book was the way that she talked about the symbolism that indigenous people were using when they were pushing back against these colonists. This is a very bloody book. It's not a happy book. It's, you know, and look, these conflicts between native people and colonists over land were quite literally a conflicts over life, right? And over their own future, generations of their descendants. So when Jill narrates these ideas about how, you know, indigenous people would cut open, you know, these colonists and shove back in their Bibles, you know, this was a real, you know, and putting mud, you know, it's like you want the land and then shoving, you know, dirt into their mouths, like, you know, choke on it. I mean, for me, it was like this is really vibrantly talked about, this exchange between Native people and colonists. So I'm sorry, Sarah, that was hijacking your
– No, it's piece. Super
yeah,
helpful.
I loved it.
Yeah, it's super helpful. I completely agree with you with how powerful that book is. And then again, you know, the detailed evidence of how, like you're saying, Jason, what violence meant and its symbolism. And for me also, like the power of narrative and the written word. When I started graduate school – or I didn't even start it. I was like a couple years in. Somebody asked me, you know, a faculty member, like, oh, did you decide to become a Western historian so you don't have to do theory? And this goes back to something you said, Josh. And I was like, well, no, but oh, I see like why you're asking that question. I can see why. Like there's you know, it's less obvious in a lot of Western history. And, you know, even in my book on the Overland Trail, like a lot of the work on it was, well, what actually happened versus what have people said happened. And I really think that what people say happened and how they imagine it and how we portray 19th century cowboys in 2024 or the early 21st century is just as important and powerful as, you know, what they were actually like what's going on with that. And for me, Name of War really opened that up for me because she talks about the importance of the writing and remembering of the war in the aftermath. Yeah.
You had mentioned Patty Limerick's book earlier. Which one was that?
Oh, I was thinking of Legacy of Conquest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like that's required reading, right?
I mean, that's got to be my third book. Also same time period for me.
And the writing you picked, it's interesting that you picked good, right? You know, because there are a lot of history books where the arguments are great mm-hmm. and the evidence is great, but they're not written like those books that you just described, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting that's an element of that stuck with you.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about films. Let's go back here. What are your favorite films on the West?
One that I like to, in my provocateur side, likes to sort of say, when I, because I've been asked this question a lot in my work history, that I just like to say to provoke, because a lot of people would say it's not a Western, is this movie called Walker from the 1980s. And it's about the filibuster William Walker who went to Nicaragua in the 1840s. So it's the director Alex Cox who made Repo Man. And mm-hmm. I think I understand that like Repo Man was made on a low budget and like was a huge hit. And so he gets a big budget to make his next film. And he decided, and this is probably the mid 80s, to make this historical drama of the 1840s with William Walker going to become emperor of Nicaragua and conquer it. And sort of as a next frontier in a sense. And Ed Harris plays William Walker, but it's also very explicitly a critique of American foreign policy in Nicaragua in the 1980s in that plays out in like purposeful anachronisms that are really fascinating as a film. I think it bombed, but it's a super interesting movie. The soundtrack is by Joe Strummer from The Clash. It's like, it's a fascinating like punk rock Western in a sense, but set in Nicaragua. So I like to like shout out that film as a kind of unexpected Western.
I love this idea. Like, I asked you for a Western. You're like, Nicaragua. My mind went, yes, let's go. Yes. Absolutely.
I don't know. Do you want to throw one in, Sarah?
Yeah, I can. Have you all seen The Writer? It came out in like 2017. Have you seen this one, Jason?
You know what? I've got the movie podcast. Both of you hit me with movies I have not seen. So I'm going to go shirk back into the – I'm going to go back to the East and withdraw from Western discourse now. No, I have not. But go ahead.
South Dakota represent. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you like it, Josh?
Really?
I loved it. Oh, I loved it. Blew my mind.
Yeah. And I think it's a really dark story, but there's some hope in there as well. You know, and the way it's sort of like rodeo riding as like maybe see it as the one way out of where they are. And then the dangers that come along with that. You know, one of the big arcs of the story is a young writer grappling with, you know, stepping down. He's got a friend who's been paralyzed from participating in the rodeo. But I think it also does a really good job of one of the things I don't think we've talked about yet is when I think of Westerns, one of the things I think about is the landscape and the environment, like as a character, not just the backdrop. It's like an integral part of the narrative. We see that in 1883. The Writer does a really good job with that too. So landscape, but also just animals, right? So the horses play a big role in both of those too. But yeah, I just love The Writer so much. And it also, it came out at this time where there were a lot of, it's a little bit of an arty independent film. And it came out at a time where a lot of arty independent films were those people in New York with feelings who were, you know, talking at each other. And then we got The Writer and I was like, ah. It's like literally
people who don't talk at all.
Yeah, that's true. So, but literally like a breath of fresh air. I could almost like feel the winds of the plains, you know, watching it. It was just great. I love that film.
Yeah, it's super interesting. So, like it's by Chloe Zhao, who then made Nomadland after. But she had made her like grad school, you know, or her first film was she just like she's Chinese American, like an immigrant from China. She had just read about Pine Ridge Reservation and just like showed up on Pine Ridge and decided to make a movie. And it's called Songs My Brothers Taught Me, I think is what it's called.
Okay.
And it's a lot of like first time actors or, you know, local folks. There's a couple of professional actors. It's a story a little bit that I've seen in kind of indie movies about res life over the past 25 years or so. But pretty good, like pretty interesting. But she ended up making a lot of friends, I think, on Pine Ridge. And then this cowboy in The Writer is also Oglala, citizen of Oglala Nation. And but it's a totally different sort of side of the reservation than it's like the cowboy side. Super interesting. And then, in fact, there's a couple moments in South Dakota in Nomadland, too, where they're not as obvious native connections, but it's a little bit there. I'm a big fan. I actually got to give her a tour at the Autry. I was like, oh, you did? Fanboy.
Lucky.
Oh, yeah.
Have either of you seen First Cow?
Not yet, but though Kelly Reichardt would be one of my people. And it came out right at the beginning of the pandemic, right? And I just haven't ever gotten to it, but I love her other movies. So I'm like, why have I not seen this yet?
What's it about?
Yeah, right.
What's it about? First Cow?
Yeah, First Cow.
Okay, need to know what it's about.
I actually read part of the novel. There's like, or at least part of it is drawn from a novel. There's this novelist, I think his name is John Raymond, that has written a lot of her screenplays. So this is the director of Meek's Cutoff, which you probably have seen, Sarah. And it came out right, like, I think it must have come out in March of 2020.
I'll give you the blurb from Amazon, because it'll okay, does a better job than I can. Two travelers, this is my narrating voice. This is my Audible audition voice right now. Two travelers on the run from a band of vengeful hunters in the 1820s Northwest dream of striking it rich, but their tenuous plan to make their fortune on the frontier comes to rely on the secret use of a landowner's prized dairy cow.
Mm.
So it's 1820s is the West, right?
Yeah.
So, all right, let me ask you maybe our ultimate question here at Historians of the Movies podcast. We'll come back down to 1883. We'll go back. Is 1883 a history show?
Yes.
You can say yes, yes. You can say no. Josh, yeah, yeah. Toy Story's a Western.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, but is it a history? I mean, to me, yeah, but the history is this, as you were saying, a dialogue between past and present, right? Like, it's a continuing conversation. And I would say this is part of the conversation about the past, even though it's a fictional and, like, you know, creative, takes creative license and so on. But for me, I have a capacious view of history. So, yes.
Yeah, absolutely a history show. And I do think that, you know, like, even in the books I mentioned, like, part of the reason why I like those books so much is they're so emotionally evocative. Like, you get the sense of how people were living and what they were going through. And I think that's where 1883 excels, at least for some of its characters, particularly for the Dutton family, that you get that sense. And the writing's really good when it's describing those things from the perspectives of the Duttons and Elsa, and you're connected to them, and you do get an understanding of what it was like to be surrounded by death and be on this really trying and traumatic journey. So yeah, for sure.
Awesome. Guys, let me ask you, where can people find you guys if they're not traveling to the West? Where can people find you on social media, online? Where can people find you for your work, for your thoughts on 1923 and other Taylor Sheridan works? Where are you guys online?
I think my email is on the Huntington's website. So I've been trying to avoid social media. Sorry.
Good for you. Good for you.
Not always successfully, but yeah, it's too rough for me.
If you think the West was a process, look at Twitter, right?
Or a brutal place with amputation.
Sarah?
Yeah, I've got a faculty page at UNR. So you just Google me, put in UNR, and I'll pull it up. I keep a couple things updated on there. And then I've tried to hit, I'm mostly on Twitter still, but I've like started to dabble in Instagram and Blue Sky and things like that. So yeah, we'll see how it all goes. I learned so much. Like, Jason, I know what you're doing. I know what other people are doing. So I don't post a ton, but I learn a lot. So yeah, you can find me there.
That is something I miss out on, but oh well.
You'll get it in other ways. And you live in LA with the center of the universe.
I know, it's like, it's amazing. It's so crazy how many people just come to the Huntington.
Yeah.
Where you're just like, what?
if you've never been to the Huntington, you kind of have to go. It's like, it's like a pilgrimage for scholars, but really most beautiful place in the United States. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. I'm so lucky. Yeah. And it's just, yeah, there's like conferences all the time. And so people are like speaking or presenting or researching all the time.
Can I tell you real fast before we go? When I was at the Huntington, I guess this would have been 2018 or so. Somewhere in that range. I was out there for a thing that Alejandro Dukovsky had set up. And, of course, I'd done a lot of work at the Newbery. And I kept trying to start shit between the Huntington and Newbery. I was like, if we can get like a Sharks Jets thing going on between libraries, if I could get them talking shit, that would be awesome. And I haven't been able to like get them to fight yet, but I'm working on it, like behind the scenes, just for my own devious purposes. So
yeah, I spent a summer at the Huntington the Newbery in the NCASE seminar in the summer once. And it's a pretty amazing place, but the weather and the garden is like, you know, for your indoor time, the archive is amazing. For your break of your breath of fresh air, we've got a slight advantage.
Well, guys, you guys have been a breath of fresh air. See what I did there? Captain's Dr. Segway over here. Guys, thank you so very much for being here, for taking the time. Like a lot of time, I asked you to watch 10 hours of show to do this. So thank you so much for being a part of this podcast. And thanks for being here, guys.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And that's a wrap here at Historians of the Movies. Thank you so very much to our guests, Sarah Kies and Josh Garrett Davis. Thank you guys both so much for being here and talking to us about 1883. I had you guys watch 10 hours of shows, to be honest. Thank you so much. Fletcher, our producer, thank you for being here, for producing this show. And of course, thank you most of all to you guys, the listeners, for being part of this. Thank you for sharing this on social media. Thank you for continuing to listen in, for sharing this with your friends. Thank you to the dog, who is currently chewing a large bone and making noise back behind me as I'm recording this. So continue to be here. Thank you for being part of all of this. We're going to have some more pods coming for you here real shortly. And that's it for now. So ciao for now. Talk to you later.